I'm going to go ahead and begin. It's just gone past B45. Some of you, most of you, have already had some sessions here, one or more sessions in genetics. But I do, for those who are new, let me just introduce myself again. I'm Mark Marenko. I teach down at Pacific University, which is not Pacific Lutheran University, but Pacific University, which is just outside Portland, Oregon. A small liberal arts college connected with seven different allied health professional programs. And I've been teaching there since 1988 in the bioethics department, and gradually came to the conclusion, teaching medical ethics year after year, that we needed to do a course on genetics, that the kinds of issues that were coming up were so profound, and little reflected on by the general public that myself and a colleague in the biology department felt that we just had to be doing more in the area of genetics. We got to the point where we applied for and got a fairly small grant to do a project with two African American groups in Portland, Oregon. And after that grant, we then decided to make a proposal to the National Institutes of Health. It's an unusual kind of situation with them in that in 1989, when Congress was deciding to fund the Human Genome Project, that James Watson, one of the two people who discovered the helical structure of DNA, insisted, insofar as you can insist on anything in Congress, that 3% of the research budget, which was a very substantial sum, 3% of the research budget should be devoted to what were described as the ethical, legal, and social issues associated with genetic science. They not only accepted this idea, but they doubled that budget to 6%, and therein began what's called the ELSI program, the Ethical, Legal, and Social Issues program. That was unprecedented. It was the first time I'm aware of where Congress decided that this particular kind of scientific investigation was going to be so provocative and so controversial and so likely to be misunderstood, not only the ethics and law, but just the science itself, that they did something like this, to set aside that kind of money. They were also particularly interested, as I looked at the request for proposals, in communities of faith, which was interesting to me because I have a degree in philosophy and sort of a straight degree in philosophy from Oxford University, and I had also done a Master of Divinity degree at Yale. So that certainly caught my attention when I was looking at the proposal, this interest in communities of faith. They told us that they were having some difficulty in trying to bring people on board or finding what they call principal investigators for the ELSI program, particularly to communities of faith. And that turns out to be for a couple of different reasons that you could probably imagine. One was that they were getting proposals from people who were so much insiders within a particular religious tradition that they seem to have an overly specific agenda for what they wanted to do with the funds with their congregations. Or they were getting proposals from people who didn't know how to make any kind of real connection with communities of faith, who understood the science and the ELSI questions, but didn't know how to translate that into issues that would be understandable to communities of faith. So our proposal then, they were interested in, we failed to get it the first time around. Second time around, we got it. Interesting, for those, again, who haven't heard me tell a story, that we didn't get it the first time around, and part of it was around the subject of diversity, where one of the research, the people who read the research proposal were saying, we can't fund this, there's no diversity here. All you're doing, this is just for Christians. How can the United States government fund something? It's just for church. We got separation. How can we do this? And we were asked to address this question. Another of the readers of our proposal looked at it and said, we can't fund this proposal. How in the world are they going to address all the diversity that they are attempting to manage in the ecumenical ministry of Oregon? going from a Roman Catholic to Mormons to Seventh-day Adventists to Quakers and Baptists. How are you going to manage that diversity? So we fed that back to them and kind of explained to them, look, you know, we're going to, this time around, try to do with what we know, to manage the traditions that are diverse enough for us, but that we can somehow manage to do this. 2-year program, and it seemed to be successful, and the program that we've been doing this week is a version of that. All right, so I'm not going to, normally what I would do is spend some time on genetic science. We've been doing that enough this week, and so I apologize to those of you who didn't, who haven't been here for that part of the presentations. So we're going to actually dive into a couple of case studies. And today's subject has to do with genetic information and social implications, social consequences, possible social consequences for the genetic science and the technologies that it spins out. I'm going to show you a little film clip here from Gattaca. This is a different one than we saw earlier this week. For those again who has seen Gattaca here, just a couple of people. So let
seen
me just
in general or seen it here.
Well, seen the whole film. Yeah. So, but let me, and then I want to say just a couple things then about the film, which will set up the this little clip that we're going to do and the case study associated with it. What you have in this film is the collision of two worlds that are pretty much incompatible. You have the world that you and I now live in, and the world that genetic science and the technologies that it spawns are projecting out. And in this particular scene, which takes place somewhere in the future, the not so distant future, the whole film begins with this couple who are conceiving a child in what for us would be thought of as sort of the normal way, through sexual intercourse, and you see them embracing, and how the child is reflecting later on how a child conceived in love is thought to maybe will probably have more happiness than a child not, and so on and so forth. How could they think these things? People don't think like that anymore. And he asks the question, how could my mother put her faith in the hands of God rather than the local geneticist in terms of the decision to play what amounts to, given the power and the knowledge that we now have, because it's science, right? How could they, given the power and knowledge, be doing something as stupid as playing Russian roulette with something as important as reproduction? That's the premise, that's how where the movie begins. Why? Because they do newborn screening, which basically is virtually mandatory in any hospital in the United States, between 8 and 40 different tests that there are ways in some ways that for religious reasons to be exempt from them, but pretty much they're mandatory in all states. And so they did a newborn screening of this child and found out that it has a fatal heart condition that will leave his lifespan at around 30 years of age. 99%
chance.
And instantly, as they read out this information, they want to give a name to the certificate, and they were going to name him after the father. The father then immediately changes that and gives him a different name. And the mother then immediately starts petting him and saying, "You'll do something, it's okay, your life will mean something," and so on. So there's this instant, from the moment of birth, labeling of this person, who then, of course, in good American cinematography fashion, wants to become an astronaut, NASA, right? And there's this disadvantaged person who hasn't even been, there's no symptoms of this, but nevertheless has been labeled in a certain way that has prevented him from being able to join NASA, becoming an astronaut, living out his dream. This movie is about the clash between that kind of world in which even through the chances that go with the kind of reproduction, that nevertheless through his sheer willpower and his character and so on, he's going to succeed in somehow. So he takes on actually an identity of someone who is engineered, where he has to every day scrub his body to make sure there's no traces of DNA left on his body that could fall off, putting blood underneath of false fingerprints so that they can test him. He walks around with pee in his on a bag in his pants and so on in case they do a urine test. And he managed to pass himself off as someone else. So he's in NASA and scheduled for a flight to outer space, right? Well, going back now to the beginning of the film, the couple now have learned their lesson. You know, as much as it might be romantic and mysterious and wonderful to procreate in that old-fashioned way, they've learned their lesson. It was wrong what they did. So they did, given the power and knowledge that they now have, they went to a genetic counselor to then select from a set of embryos, right? Embryos that they had then artificially created, now outside the womb, so they have all of these, all of them have been tested, and the genetic counselor then talks with them about these embryos, and they select the embryo that they want. They decided they wanted a brother, for Vincent is the name of the young boy in the film. And they, you know, he says, you know, you've specified hazel eyes and fair skin. Of course, the genetic counselor is bald and black. Says, and no predispositions to any prejudicial conditions like premature baldness and myopia and so on and so on and so forth. So they end up selecting an embryo for implantation that has that screened for genetic defects. And also, in some ways, they're able to make some choices at this level about certain traits as well. So these are the two brothers. And the film is about the world that one lives in and the world that another lives in. And in the film, you find all kinds of strange scenarios. For example, polydactylism, you know, where someone might be born with extra digits or something. And in the film, there's a man who plays the piano and throws a... his glove off after the end, everyone's applauding, and he has 12 fingers. And he was engineered to have 12 fingers in order to be a virtuoso pianist who could play music that only he could play, that only someone with 12 fingers could play. Right? So is polydactylism a disorder? Is it a disease? Is it a disability? Is it just a trait? Yesterday we talked about a case in which a couple came and who were deaf and wanted to find out if their fetus was going to be deaf. And the pastor who was dealing with them and talking about the subject suddenly realized that their intention was to abort this fetus if it could hear. Not if it was deaf, but if it could hear. They did not want to raise a child that could hear. They felt that they were parents who were deaf. They wanted to raise a child who was deaf. And they viewed their world as a kind of a culture. And they wanted to preserve that culture. Didn't have any idea how to be a parent to a kid who could hear. So they wanted to have an abortion based on the genetic test that would reveal whether or not that child was going to be able to hear or not. That's not the case we're going to do today. But that's one of the ones we've done in the past. All right, so the film clip then, one of the implications of genetic testing, the capability for us to do genetic testing, is that we can also do something called genetic profiling. Instead of just testing for a particular allele, or cystic fibrosis, or sickle cell anemia, or Huntington's disease, or diabetes, or something of that sort, we might be able to do an entire profile of a person and get all kinds of information about them. One of the things you can do then is look at the alleles and determine those markers that would be unique to that person and be able to have a device that could be used in forensics, right? That would be 1,000 times or more accurate than fingerprinting. You guys remember the O.J. Simpson trial, right? We were hearing every day about alleles and so on and so forth, and it ended up not making a difference in that particular case. But genetic testing for use of identification has been around a long time. And the case we are going to look at has to do with a case study from California and some problems that are arising now in the UK, where they are doing an increasing number of people are being put in databases, genetic profile databases, to be able to help investigators find the person who's committed a crime. Okay, so that's one of the cases we're going to do. So that's one of the things we can do with this information. Another thing that can be done with it, obviously, is to, when you do a complete genetic profile, that insurance companies would, as part of the process, the intake process of getting a medical history, you know, I mean, and determining pre-existing conditions, right, so on and so forth, may want you to take a genetic test. I'm on the advisory board to the state legislature in Oregon on genetic privacy, and we have fairly strict laws, actually very strict laws, about the use of genetic testing by insurance companies. But all of the concepts are at least in place here for this idea. What does pre-existing condition mean? You know, in the light of the 1,000 or more genetic tests we can do that tell us just an enormous amount about ourselves and our family, our family's medical history, and the projection of our medical history into the future. Huge. It's a huge question. Also, socially, it might be useful, and that's what we'll look at here in this case, what we call the dating ritual. Boy meets girl, they begin to fall in love, and they have a relationship that becomes more serious, and they begin contemplating a future, possibly having children, right? Combining their genetic histories. And as you remember, we already said, the whole film Gattaca has to do with this question, are we going to be living in a time where it's going to be thought irresponsible to reproduce in any other way than through pre-implantation genetic screening? So then the couple then are going to want to know about each other. They're going to want to understand more of their family history and so on, especially if they're responsible adults who are thinking, is this person not only someone I enjoy being with and I'm in love with, is this someone who would be an appropriate candidate for being father of my children? That's a different question. We did a case 2 days ago, a woman who got pregnant. Genetic counselor, and this was in Oregon, in fact, where the person got pregnant and came to the genetic counselor at around 7 weeks wanting to know if the fetus had Huntington's disease. Very specific, you can test for this and so on. And this was an odd situation to the genetic counselor, and the story unfolded. She was married. She was a fiancée of a man. She was considering marrying, obviously. He had a history of Huntington's in his family, absolutely refused to be tested, did not want to know if he had the allele for Huntington's. She wanted to find out information about him. She gets pregnant, she goes to the counselor to try and get a test on the fetus, to try and find out, get information about him. So, in other words, what we can do with genetic information is learn a lot about someone who we are getting close to, and where the consequences of combining genomes may be pretty significant, right? So that might change the dating ritual. So let's just look at this clip then. You're going to hear him described as Jerome. His name is Vincent, but the person he took on is named Jerome. And it turns out that she has had him sequenced. And it turns out that he thought for a minute that he had been found out and was going to end up being caught. But then it turns out that what she got was something from the person whose identity he had taken on. So she's happy with the sequencing that she got from him. So here's what happens in this sequence.
Jerome? I had you sequenced. I read your profile. I'm sorry. Seems you're everything they say you are and more.
But you are, Irene. You're an engineer just like the rest of us.
Not quite like the rest of you. Unacceptable likelihood of heart failure. I think that's what the manual says. The only trip I'll take in space is around the sun and the satellite right here.
Well, if there's anything wrong with you, I can't see it from where I'm standing.
If you don't believe me, here, take it. If you're still interested, let me know.
I'm sorry, the wind caught.
Okay, so here he is. I mean, did you catch that little gesture? You know, he takes the little strand of hair and he lets it go, basically. The message being, I don't give a damn about the genetics. I care about you. Right. Recapitulating the stupidity of his parents. Right? That's the question. You know. Was that an act of faith? Was that a determination to stand, you know, within a posture of faith in a place where what it means to be in love has nothing to do with a person's genetic profile, genetic past or his or future? You know? Was he nothing but the, you know, a kind of a pathetic Don Quixote here, like his parents in the car? So, yeah, you have a comment?
I think he was doing it because he knows what his genetic profile it says, and he knows it's crap. You know, he's like, here I am, and I'm able to impersonate and do everything that's expected of this perfect engineered person, and all those percentages of what was going to happen to me weren't true.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what he's saying is, he's just saying, I don't have faith in the science either.
But he noticed he's not telling her.
Right,
by the way, I'm not really your roommate.
Yeah, he didn't breach any of his own
secrets.
But,
I mean, I think he's not making a comment about how he feels about love and all that. He's making a comment about what he thinks of the quality of the science. Like, we've gotten a little too wrapped up in it, and we don't know as much as.
That's possible. Of course, we do have, you know, early in the movie, we do have him talking like, you know, what possessed my mother to put her hands in the, you know, her faith in the hands of God rather than the Lord.
Because that was not the social norm. But the social norm is not always something that you think is the smartest thing.
I think he's saying for Uma Thurman, he'll take a chance.
Okay. So, are you? If you can share a bit, there's.
Oh wait, here I got two. I know we have some more.
Try to preserve. To preserve paper, if I could. Okay, so try it out this way. I'm running it this way. So your daughter, Jeannie, senior at Pacific University, she met her boyfriend Kevin in an introduction to genetics course. They've been taught that while not the only causal influence, the best predictor of someone's health history, including mental and behavioral factors, okay, is that person's genetic profile. She's home for the summer. She announces that she and Kevin are considering marriage. While she talks about Kevin, she brings out an envelope and shows you a strand of Kevin's hair. At first, you think it's just a slightly odd romantic artifact. Then Jeannie says that what she wants to do is to have the hair genetically analyzed in order to find out everything she can about Kevin's genetic profile. Now, the cost for this, by the way, has come down to around $400 to do a fairly thorough genetic profile of yourself.
Or someone else.
Then Jeannie says that what she wants to do, She tells you that she loves him very much, but marriage is a lifelong commitment bigger than romance. At least she's smart enough to know that. They will certainly want children, and these children must be considered. She cites the high divorce rate, stating that she does not want any disappointing surprises after she's married. She just wants to make an informed choice. So she has the power and the knowledge to get information that's relevant to her in her decision-making about a future spouse. Any problems here so far? She wants to know what her future will probably be like with Kevin and what his genetic contribution to her children's future will be. She seems clear and confident about her goals, but you can detect some uncertainty in her voice and demeanor. She asks you what you think about her ideas. Now, while we were at Dartmouth for a two-week NIH-sponsored conference a few years ago, we saw a video, a short documentary on a woman who agreed to be filmed going through the process of making a decision about whether or not she wanted to be tested for Huntington's. And for those of you who don't know, that Huntington's doesn't show up usually until you're 40 or 50 years old. And it's passed on, it's a dominant disorder, which means that it only takes is one allele from either of your parents to give you the disease. If you have that one allele, you're going to get the disease. And it, given the current state of our knowledge of the disease, that you will suffer and die from it. Terrible, terrible disease. So she had agreed that she was going to do this. She decided she wanted to be tested. And towards the end of the video, it was painful. We almost asked them to turn the thing off. It was so painful to watch because she had, in the end, regretted having agreed to the filming, that the test was positive. She had the allele for Huntington's. And at the end of the thing, she lost her fiance and her job. And neither of them said it had anything to do with the genetic test. But nevertheless, those are the facts, right? So getting information about someone's genetic profile can have profound personal and social consequences. So she asks you what you think about her idea here. She's got some hair here. She wants to find out about Kevin and wants to plunk down the $400 to find out about him. Dean?
Getting the information whether you have the allele for Huntington's disease would be one thing, but then if you do have it, you go to the next step, and if you have an embryo, you could test that to see if that took the allele, right? Because maybe it did or maybe it didn't, right? You have, or is it automatic that it will be passed on if the woman has it?
No, it's not automatic. It's 50-50 chance.
Right. And so it's 50-50 chance, so that just simply means, okay, you've got it. So now you want to test the embryo to make sure that the potential child is not going to have it.
One choice you would have, knowing that you have the allele, would be to use pre-implantation genetic screening to discard embryos that had that allele.
Right. And so if you were of the mindset to get to be tested so that you knew, it seems like you would go to that next step and make sure that your offspring didn't have the allele.
Assuming your fiance stayed in town.
Yeah.
She was getting tested not about a kid, just to find out about this herself. No, the woman you were talking about, the film of the UK woman.
Oh.
Just to find out about herself.
Yeah, it was just to find out about herself, about her future, about her future.
No, but I guess I'm saying maybe it's just in my mind that I'm confused about it, because I don't know why it would be such a big problem, because you could have more information later, supplement the information about the embryo, and then make another decision at that time not to have a child that end up with the allele.
Yeah, I think the assumption you're making is that the purpose of the test in her case was about whether or not to have children.
Yeah.
And she, there's a lot of other, it's a bit like finding out,
right,
you know,
right,
in about 20 years you're going to be taken to a torture chamber,
right,
and here's the kind of things that they're going to do to you, and here's likely how you will end up dying.
Yeah.
So you have that.
Right.
And then the all of the social consequences of that knowledge for you in terms of anyone you might disclose that to. And just as you may feel an obligation, though doing enough ethics cases to know that this isn't automatically the case, a moral obligation to tell your potential spouse that you're HIV positive or something, you may feel an obligation to disclose to them something of this nature as well. Well, let's just look at the questions on the back here and see where you are on this kind of a case. One ostensible purpose of dating is to get to know each other, right? In order to see if the couple are compatible, right? Get to know each other and see if you're compatible. The couple learns about each other's history and each other's families. How is this idea of genies different, if at all, from getting to know each other, finding out if they're genetically compatible, right?
To me, it makes a difference whether he knows that she's doing this.
Yeah, if he thinks it's part of getting to know each other, then it is. And
yeah.
He should be testing her.
Yeah, has she been tested?
Does she know that she's a perfect specimen? No.
Okay. So, one of the things we do in ethics is to isolate those things that are truly morally relevant to your decision-making process. Would it make a difference to you if Kevin, in this case, had knowledge and had given consent to have this test?
Mm-hmm.
For some people it would, for some it wouldn't.
Because he needs to know that he's not dealing with somebody who's looking at him as a potential mate in a, you know, romantic sense or whatever, but it has a certain cold kind of approach to.
No, he may have the same approach, but he's not given the opportunity to synchronize approaches.
Yeah, and you just described this as a cold approach.
Yeah, I mean, this is not cold, but it's a little calculating. It's
I think it's cold. That was my first reaction. This is really cold.
Well,
you know, and it might make a difference to him. Like, well, why don't you love me anyway?
So that moves us towards that group of people who might say, irrespective of consent and all that stuff, you might be alleviating some of your concerns with that. That's a separate issue. But the doing of it itself may still have moral remainders for us to discuss here. It sounds like, for some of you, it does.
It's sort of like asking somebody about their finances or something. Well, we're here together, and this is, you know, something I need to know, and if it's not good, it's a deal breaker, you know. And you can get that knowledge surreptitiously, or you can just ask the person. You know,
and but I suppose that in the background, for some of you who share, even with your comment of being kind of cold, is that there's something about the sort of commitment that goes with from going from romance to family, and this is where our theological traditions may have something to say about all this as well. There's something about going from romance to family that has some quality of unconditionality about it, in sickness or health, for better or for worse. For richer, for poorer, for Huntington's or no Huntington's, cancer or no cancer. It's just in this case, we're all of a sudden in a position of knowledge and power to find out all kinds of things about that person's future that
we
wouldn't
have
known. So your hand's been up for quite some time, and then in the back.
I just have a question. At what point in the relationship is this testing occurring? I mean, is there a relation? If there were no relationship and the testing occurred, such as with Match.com or eHarmony or something, where you identify characteristics that you have and you put it online and then somebody else reads it and says, oh, that looks like someone that I might get to know better. Could it be part of that? I mean, at what point does it become a rejection of loving a whole person?
Well, I don't know if some of you were here for some of Sunitha's presentations on arranged marriage and so on. That yes, and there's a lot actually to be argued for and said, however else you might think about it, against what they would describe as a love match, the whole thing where you start with romantic attraction and interest and so on. Then if you're lucky, you kind of build in the other stuff like values, common values and how you intend to raise your children, all that stuff. You're hoping that'll fit in with this strong, powerful attraction that you have to the person. And guess what? We have a divorce rate that's pretty high, you know, and so on and so forth. So you know, the argument for arranged marriage is that you do have a kind of a match.com process going on where families act as dating agencies. They kind of screen for certain things so that you end up with a pool of people who are going to likely be compatible for the marriage stuff once all the romance stuff, if it happens, you know, goes away or fades and comes and goes and so on, are going to still be there for the long haul. So they're trying to be responsible about it. Is that, now you move that here, is it with this sort of thing where you're on one of the categories in Match.com might be genetic profile. Have you been genetically profiled? Could you share your genetic profile online? And you're going to rule out certain kinds of things. So you end up, before you're even dating, with a pool that not only includes the kind of stuff that Sunitha might talk about in India, but also might include, you've already ruled out, you know, people who have a genetic history for Huntington's but are refusing to be tested or something like that. Who don't want to reveal the genetic... What's wrong with them? Why don't they want to reveal their genetic tests? Right? You want to make sure you're only going to see some... Is that the same kind of thing? It doesn't feel the same, but it might be. Yeah, on the back, you had a comment or question.
I was just struck, as I looked at the question, by the word compatible. And I'm a retired pastor, and I've done a lot of pastoral counseling for people who were planning to marry. And in one way or another, we are looking at some indicators of their degree of compatibility, not in the sense of genetic compatibility, but other kinds of compatibility. And so I see this and I'm thinking, well, how do we define compatibility? And it seems to me now that we're facing one additional indicator of whether or not a man and woman are quote unquote compatible.
Well, let me ask you, as a pastor, I assume you still feel, you said you're retired. Yeah, did you say that? You retired?
I'm sorry?
Did you say you're retired?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I want to make sure I didn't insult you. I didn't say you're retired. Nevertheless, you have a pastor's mind, the way you think. Does this feel to you like a natural extension of what you would want to encourage couples to do to find out if they're compatible?
I guess this being really the first time that I have heard of this, I'm not ready to answer that question.
That's a beautiful answer, because I'm very much interested in doing a lot more continuing education for pastors around this area. I did something for Vancouver School of Theology for a week on this, and there seems to be a lot of interest to learn a lot more about this, so that this is going to happen more and more, where genetic testing is going to be a part of the pastoral care and guidance. What we can't do in the law is, we nevertheless, perhaps through our traditions, our communities of faith, have some kind of a posture towards, some kind of stance that we might take about some of these issues. But it's so new to our thinking about it. Many of us just don't know. We don't know what to do with this yet. And we need to have lots of conversations until we're actually being able to see what's really going on in a case like this. Yes, your hand was up.
Well, first of all, if she wants to find out if they're genetically compatible, and she feels she's acting a little uncomfortable about it, her genetic testing is equally important. So I might suggest that she have her genome tested, and then discuss with her fiancé if he was interested in finding out whether they were genetically compatible.
Well, it'd be interesting.
Do you know at the moment what kind of information people get when they get these?
Oh, they get lots of information.
You can find out if you have alleles for particular diseases.
Sure, yeah. And what your risks are for various kinds of diseases. They'll do an algorithm that will show what's your increased risk for heart disease, say, or a particular kinds of cancer, perhaps.
Can I say my
or okay, my son. Damn, I'm sorry, Dad. You know, it's like, you know, in my class, the cell phones and so on. I thought, if any place we'd get away from that is here, then son's walkie-talkie. So, but notice that again, in bringing that back, there's issues about fairness, certainly, and so on and so forth. But I think for a number of, even of those who would be satisfied, at least in some measure, if she were going to be tested too, and if there was consent and so on, still feel uneasy about this as being a kind of normative way for getting information, for making decisions about things like marriage. I think. Yeah.
I'm curious about what extent, well, first of all, I'm a psychologist, I wouldn't throw out that bias. To what extent psychological research about the decision-making process has been brought into this kind of debate? And I'll give you a couple of examples. One is that it's found that that people can only accommodate a certain amount of information in making a decision, and how much information you give them determines how happy they are with the decision. So, for example, you might give a person a choice between 3 jams. When they eat the toast, they'll be a lot happier than if you give them a choice between 9 jams, okay? So one thing that occurs to me is that, yeah, she might get this download of all this information about this genetic structure and then be pulling her hair out, trying to narrow that down to some kind of, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down decision. And
then she's going to be unhappy about her decision.
Exactly, yeah. So that would be one realm that would be relevant. Another thing that struck me was that the people are, in a number of certain kinds of ways, have a lot of difficulty predicting what their satisfaction is going to be with something in the future. And there's a lot of psychological research on that sort of thing. And one quick example would be that if you lose a limb, people will, you know, you would think about that and you'd think, oh my gosh, you know, it would be catastrophic, or even 2 limbs. Turns out, a year later, when they've actually measured this sort of thing, if you lose some appendages, it hardly makes any measurable difference in happiness a year later. Or on the flip side, win the lottery. There's a lot of adjustment that goes on in that year, but a year later, a person tends to be about as happy.
As they were before
the incident occurred. So people have difficulty predicting that sort of thing. And so and I'm thinking that may occur culturally as well. So for example, right now we're reacting to some of this and some person said, gosh, that seems really cold. But on the other hand, maybe 30 years from now, when this is all just second nature to everyone, it won't seem cold at all. And it'll just seem like another decision.
That's interesting. I thought you were going to say something else. I thought you were going to say something like, if a person is this preoccupied with the nuances of choices that they might be able to make, that they're going to basically find something, no matter what, that it's going to create already a predisposition to saying no to things.
Clearly she's not sold on.
I thought you were going to say something else. Pardon?
She's clearly not sold on Kevin. And she's looking for something else to push her over the edge.
Well,
you know, but the thing is, somebody might have said that 100 years ago about things that we all consider today, because the information is so readily available. So that's why I'm thinking.
But having more information to consider, does that always give us a better outcome or make us happier? Generally not. You know?
Well, this is, and remember, this is information that doesn't have anything to do with her observations of Kevin and her interactions with him, right? This is all information that's hidden in the genome, right? That may even be contradictory to what her observations are, particularly as these tests get more sophisticated and can measure things like susceptibility to addictions.
Mark, do you see this as sort of a new form of fortune telling? I don't think it would be unusual for a young person to get their palm read or consult a tarot expert or something like that, just because there's a little bit of, ooh, how's this going to work?
Or 500 years ago, that might have been a matter of course in a particular culture.
Uh-huh. Well, sure.
Now we're just better at it.
Like comparing horoscopes when a couple was matched, which is still done in some cultures.
This is new to me. I mean, I'm
Well, okay, I mean, that may sound like a very provocative statement, which it was, because now we have Hitler involved here. But nevertheless, it certainly, if it were something that became part of the norm, and, you know, the Match.com thing there, that would be one more thing where you would have increasingly nuanced tastes or nuanced, you know, aspirations for your prospective partner. One more thing to project onto for happiness, right? And you might be saying something that what that would do would, since these things are fairly, you know, normed by culture and media and so on, that it would increasingly narrow the scope of the sort of person who you would likely want to be married to, right? And you're saying something like that. So that does have the connotations of a kind of eugenics, in the sense that who you select would then be propagating that thing that you've selected, right? So there is that connotation with it.
Earlier, Angus said something about it being kind of a cold thing, but if two people were dating and one was very conservative with their money, a saver, and found out that the other one was a spender, they may well decide that they didn't want to marry them. And as I understand it, like, finances might be the number one reason for divorces. But I mean, I think I'm a saver. If I was in that situation, 25 years of age, and found out the other, and know what I know now, I would make that cold decision. I think that I didn't want to, it would be bad.
It's just, you need to know what sort of person you're dealing with. Like, how are you going to decide to marry me? And if you're a hopeless romantic, you might be offended by that. You know what I mean? It's another way of pairing people.
And if you took that criteria, I mean, you're right. It's sex, money, children, time. And I think it's one of their, if you use John, research of John Gottman and so on, there's very specific things. And those kinds of things you can pretty much kind of get a feeling for the longer you're with someone and see how these things work out.
Without a genetic, that
these are the things that tend to make or break marriages. Not that you're going to have, that not if you're, that you're likely to not have conflict about these things. It turns out that most couples do have conflicts about most or all of those things. It's how you resolve those conflicts, your style, how you have compatible styles in resolving them. That's the difference between marriages that make it not. Not the not having conflicts about these things so much. But
I'm just saying that could be a co-decision thing on them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That for me would make sense.
Yeah. And notice now, you know, going back to Dean's comment here too, that we have some issues that here that have to do with reproduction, that is to say, the circumstances under which you would want to get genetic tests in order to know whether or not you want to, say, adopt, or you want to procreate, or if you have the technology available to you, to use technologies like pre-implantation genetic screening to try and rule out the worst of your family genetic history, right? But that's one set of issues. The other is all these other things we're now talking about in terms of assessing the compatibility or suitability of someone to become a family member with you, right? And those aren't you know, those are different kinds of
things. One of the things I didn't throw in this example, she's also going to find out if he's likely to get this disease, and she's going to have to take care of him when he's 40 or 50 while he's dying.
Well, that's the point. I mean, that's my point. Is that when we get married, we do, in that sense, from a genetic standpoint, we may have some idea in terms of family history, but we're largely playing Russian. We are playing kind of genetic Russian roulette. We got a friends who they didn't have anything that they were aware of in their family's genetic history. Three kids, one of them institutionalized, two had the same sort of thing, but not institutionalized, three boys. Basically, something was going on. You know, and had they had a genetic test, they might have made different reproductive choices. Now, enter, for those of you who haven't heard my little spiel on Adrienne Ashe, she's a blind bioethicist who argues against all prenatal genetic testing, all of it, wants to eliminate it, period. And she has two simple arguments for it, whether you agree with them or not, very simple arguments. One, it doesn't have to do with abortion, by the way, either, her arguments. One, that that when you abort a fetus on the basis of some genetic trait, some genetic feature, you're basically, what she's saying is that the message to the community of people with disabilities is that we would live in a world without you the way that you are if we could. So for her, it even as a person who's not speaking from within a community of faith, she's saying what it means to be a human being is not connected with these disabilities that we're so anxious now to find some way of getting rid of. That's one of her first point. Her second point is that it completely misunderstands what it means to be a parent. And that to be a parent isn't to somehow eliminate all possible suffering insofar as you can for your children, but to find ways of standing with them in solidarity and love and the inevitable suffering that they're going to have as a human being in some way. And that suffering, like St. Paul says, again, you don't have to be a religious person, I think, to get this point, is that suffering somehow has a constructive, by constructive I mean it informs our self-understanding in a way that most of us who are, you know, in our 40s, 50s, and 60s, and so on, finally sort of appreciate that we wouldn't be able to have the kind of pleasures that we have in valuing the things we have without the suffering we've had, even if we would have made choices not to have the suffering, right? So the suffering plays some role here, and to become preoccupied and obsessed with trying to eliminate all possible genetic problems here is to introduce, to use a phrase of my friend Michael Banner, who's also a biologist, you know, a kind of another, it's to introduce another disease, you know. This preoccupation with health. We didn't used to have sections in the newspaper on health. You know, it's like now there's these big sections and everything in health. It's like everyone's preoccupied with our body, you know, their bodily health. And so like, and he's saying, you know, that all this stuff with genetics is just making all that worse. Whether you agree with Adrienne Asher's argument or not, I can run the chess game with you on her argument itself. But that's her kind of simple argument against prenatal testing, let alone pre-implantation genetic screenings. You know, how who are we to make judgments about values of lives based on how long they are and what shape they take? Yeah, who? Yeah, that's her argument. Mark and Dean.
The other thing is that there's a big bias here that we, as able-bodied people, looking at someone who, you know, is paraplegic or whatever, like I was making the comment earlier, we're assuming that they're not happy. Because I wouldn't be happy if I lost both my arms, and I assume I wouldn't be for years, but it turns out that's a wrong conclusion to come to, at least on average. So I think, you know, that's an issue too, is some of these things that we'd be screening for, we assume are associated with the future being's happiness, and may well not be. And I want to come back to that original question of whether there have been whether the psychology of decision making has been brought into this kind of debate. Do you know?
No, not at all.
It really should be. So.
Well, it's a good thing that we're friends.
We'll talk some more. Dean.
Away from the issue of procreation, then, it just seems to me like it's a different issue if Kevin knows, if the two people know, as opposed to it being a secret, because it gives each partner a chance to say, well, if that's information that's important to you, I'm still in it with you, or I'm not. And so they're making decisions for themselves with full information, or with the information that they've chosen to have. So I think I would fall on the side of the people that say that's a really significant part of the picture. And I'm not sure of what the arguments would be to move me out of that camp.
I guess it comes down to, do you believe in love or reason?
But if you've got a partner you're considering, and they say, I want you to be genetically tested, then you can say, you know, you can make up your mind based on their desire.
Well, you can if you're the sort of person who wants to find a mate that way. I mean, what I have observed in my own life and in others is that people fall in love with people who have the ability to drive them nuts. And this is my own life, is that you seek out people that match your list of things you want in a person, they're kind of dull. And and so the genetic testing is another way to be very rational in your approach to finding a mate. On the other hand, I don't know how much use I got for these rational approaches, really, because they, in my own life, they have been ultimately have resulted in fairly unsatisfying relationships. Now, the ones that what you would need is the person who drives you crazy, but as you said, you have to have constructive methodologies in the relationship to resolve and deal with these conflicts. But it seems to me if you go about this rational way and have their genetic test, you don't have the inclination to solve the problems because this person is not that interesting to you in the first place. They just match all of your rational criteria.
What I'm saying is, my position is, if I know that the person wants me to be genetically tested, I can use that information to say, this isn't going to work.
Exactly. You want someone to love you.
Exactly. And so that's where to have the information, as opposed to being secret, testing me secretly, that's just to be totally.
Yeah, and because
you know that that's what they want to do, might be a deal breaker for me. I said, no,
I mean, the other day, the information we don't know is that Kevin wants to marry her.
Maybe Kevin doesn't care.
Yeah.
Because of time, I just want to make one comment about here, and then there's a couple more people who haven't had a chance to speak either. You said, if you're the sort of person that.
Yeah.
Right? And I just want to make a point about that. We didn't show the stuff we did earlier in the week about Neil Postman and how technology. I'm really noticing this in higher education, how the technology guys, the IT guys, has somehow permeated upper administration and seemed to impose all kinds of technology on us, and that these things have the effect of changing the sort of persons that we are in a way, in terms of the things we look for, the questions we ask, the options that we can imagine for ourselves. You know, what becomes the de facto background for our lives? All the things get set in some way by the technology that we surround ourselves with. So I guess my point with a case like this is that once you have the power and the knowledge, coming back to this, once you have the power and the knowledge about genetic science and the technologies that come off of it here, does that change? You know, Postman says that every technology has within it at least one powerful idea. And it's usually uncritiqued until it's too late. this idea. Does the technology itself begin changing who we are such that we make the kinds of decisions that you're suggesting? I want to say that in the back, you haven't had a chance to
speak. I'm sorry.
I wonder if there's a sense of compassion that could be gained from two people who have both been genetically profiled and have both found flaws within themselves and the other person, and yet still agree to get married. Does it not add to the value of saying in sickness and in health that I'm going to take care of you, even though I'm at moderate risk for this and you're at likelihood for that?
Is knowing what they're moderately at risk for relevant, do you think, to the decision-making process about being married? I mean, would you want to know ahead of time, say, that your potential partner, what kind of in sickness and in health, what that's going to look like specifically?
I mean, I guess if it were a standard option, I would kind of hope that my partner would want to know about me, what they're likely to face in our lifetime together, and would still make that commitment to me, regardless of what my profile might say about my potential future as a sound individual or not.
Gosh, I don't know.
Greater love and commitment if you're going to marry somebody knowing they're going to have Huntington's and you're going to nurse them through. And they know you know that. You know, when you're saying I do, then that
really
says a lot about your love for them. You know?
I think there's some really cool movies, I think, that have this theme. I mean, where two people fall in love, then one of them discovers that they've got something, you know, and that just makes the other person love them more and want to get married. I think in real life it can easily turn out just the opposite. But I don't know. But yeah, you haven't had it. I just wanted to go for those who haven't had any chance to speak yet.
What we're looking at is we're looking at people that are random choices. I mean, generations back, when people didn't travel around as much, two people knew what the other person's history was, because they knew who their grandparents had been, and how long they had lived, and what they had died from on both sides. And that was a common thing, that people understood what genetic background you were buying into.
Yeah, there's selection that's gone on for many, you know, there's been selection all along. And the question is this just a logical extension of that? Or is this something else that's going on? Now, we had the bell just rang. I wanted to ask you, know, for how many of you was this a very frustrating conversation? I think in the sense that we haven't, I don't think we've reached much of a sense of conclusion here, a consensus or conclusion about what, say, the Lutheran Church's policy should be in terms of counseling people, how we deal with this, right? But what I want to do is make a case for many and many, many more of these kind of conversations that don't have to end with me, the speaker, or someone else saying, well, you know, we've done all of this, here's where I think we are. I think given the nature of the science and the technology, what we need right now are lots of frustrating conversations that will provide us with an environment to be able to eventually, I think, come to a place where we can use certain principles that I think are largely derived from our traditions. And I have hints of them along the way. But they haven't come into real clear focus for me either. But I know that there's no shortcuts to getting there. We need insight before we get to truth, I think, in a sense. And to get that insight, we need lots more of these kind of frustrating, open-ended conversations where the bell's rung and, wait a minute, what is it, you know? We're not ready to break, but even if we had another hour, we still wouldn't be ready to break. Okay, that's it.